40 states are ready to settle with the nation's big banks over abusive foreclosure practices.
Why are the other 10 holding out?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, February 7th.
Coming up, a conversation with Delaware's Attorney General on why he's not ready to sign on to a big nationwide settlement with the big banks.
Two of the biggest companies you've never heard of are getting together.
And iguanas. That is all you need to know.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
So far, 40 states have signed on to a national settlement with the nation's big banks. It would force the banks to pay people who lost their homes to foreclosure and reduce costs for homeowners who are underwater.
That's in exchange for dropping civil lawsuits against banks accused of engaging in abusive foreclosure practices. But several states are holding out for a better deal. One of those is Delaware, and that state's Attorney General Beau Biden joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you haven't signed on to this settlement with the banks yet. Why not?
Well, we have questions still, and specifically as it relates to MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, which our state sued in October of last year. And we want to make sure that we can preserve our complaint and our lawsuit against them. We have some other questions, and we're working our way through those. These are not dissimilar to the questions that the New York Attorney General has, as well as it relates to MERS and the lawsuit he filed against MERS and the banks on Friday. So we're working our way through some questions that maintain our ability to pursue MERS and potentially sign on. But we have to make sure that we can preserve that right.
And just to clarify, MERS, which we've talked about on this program, is this system that allowed banks to transfer the ownership of mortgages without going through county recorder's offices and local government offices. It made it a lot quicker. Are the other states going to go ahead without you with this settlement? Is it your sense that they're close to a deal?
I don't know. I mean, I read the same reports you're reading this morning. It sounds like Attorney General Miller is saying that 40 or so states have signed on, but looks like about a dozen or so, or 10 at least, have not. Big states, it's reported, like California, and Kamala Harris has been one of the leaders of this entire investigation, has not. It's Paris. Apparently, there's reports today that Florida has not yet. Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, Nevada, I know, has not. They still have questions. So there's still questions that attorneys general are asking to make sure that they can preserve the investigations that many of us have before we sign onto this settlement.
But if you hold out and the other states go ahead, of course, homeowners in Delaware who were foreclosed on or are underwater would get absolutely nothing. Isn't that a big risk?
Well, it is a risk. But look, my job is to pursue the case I have against MERS. I think going after MERS is one of the central elements of making sure that we don't end up here again 5, 10, 15 years from now. So that's why I'm filed a major lawsuit against MERS, which is kind of tough to explain, but there's a big complaint on our website if anybody wants to see what that's all about. But the other piece of it is that the reality is the servicing standards are going to change no matter what. The banks who robo-signed are going to change based on the public pressure being brought to bear, the OCC rules that are going to require them to change. And so there'll be relief for all citizens and borrowers to some extent or level at some level for sure.
Let me ask you this, Attorney General. What have you learned about the housing market in the course of this investigation that you've been involved in for years now that you didn't know before?
I've learned that in the effort to rush millions upon millions upon millions of dollars to Wall Street, that many of these servicing banks, many of the entities involved, and there's a lot of blame to go around, have literally lost track of who owns what in America. Lost track of who owns what in America and the rush to move money to Wall Street it is that bad. I recommend to anyone listening this morning to try to find out and make sure they know who owns their mortgage. It's very difficult to find out. It's very difficult for people who are lucky enough to be able to retain an attorney to find out who owns their mortgage. These folks have lost track of who owns what, and part of the people who have lost track of that are MERS, and that's why we sued them and are going to continue our lawsuit. And that's why I see Eric Schneiderman suing them as well on Friday.
Sounds like you think that you're better off keeping the option available to sue than to go along with the settlement.
I never give up my, I never can and never should, and attorney generals should never give up their ability to do their job, and that's what I need to do, and I can't have anything limit my ability to do my job. Investigations are going to go forward. The investigation I have against MERS, other investigations, Chris Koster in Missouri, for instance, just criminally indicted one of the servicers here, an outfit called Doc X, who is famous for robo-signing the name Linda Green. He indicted the president of that company last Friday. So these investigations will continue. Attorneys General are making sure that their ability to criminally and civilly pursue the people responsible for this, that our ability to pursue them is not hindered. And that's why you see an attorneys general asking these tough questions before they sign on to this document.
Bo Biden is the attorney general of the state of Delaware. Bo Biden, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Now let's get some reaction from our regular Tuesday analyst, Julie Neiman of Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning.
So could a settlement like the one that Bo Biden was just talking about being skeptical of help the housing market?
It will, but there's still hammering to go here because Nevada's AG has the same concerns. They don't want to see a federal government global settlement because you always trade real damages in exchange for a wish to bring it to an end, call it bygones. And Missouri's attorney general is taking an entirely different tactic. He's filing a forgery fraud suit against the banks for robo-signing. So there's a lot to be hammered out, but everybody wants to get this pressing on. And the government HARP program, which is that renegotiation of interest rates and purchases, really is starting to work. The banks have to really get behind it and reduce interest rates. This will clear the decks.
All right. Well, these are a lot of things that are going on right now to try to help the housing market. Let's zoom out for a second and just let me ask you, where are we with that? When are we going to reach a bottom in terms of prices?
Well, how do you bottom out? Two things. First of all, new housing construction, and we have turned the corner. Last week's data and some related positive news on jobs reports in the private sector is very encouraging here. So it looks like new housing construction has bottomed out. Pricing. Well, there's a big lag with the Case-Shiller Index. That's November. CoreLogic is December. But the good news right there is sales rates for all homes, new and used, have flatlined for almost a month now. So less inventory on the market is going to release pricing pressure downward, downward pricing pressure. But that won't happen unless the banks are a pal and go along.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
After 5 years of arguing, a pile of stopgap funding measures, and complaints from labor unions, Congress has come up with a roadmap governing air travel in America. The FAA gets its funding. GPS navigation will play a much bigger role in our skies. And the legislation requires that within 5 years, robots will be permitted to share more of American skies. Marketplace's David Gura is in Washington. Good morning, David.
Morning, David.
So why did this take so long to get what is ultimately a funding bill for the Federal Aviation Administration?
Well, some of this, I must admit, is just typical Washington, but a huge stumbling block here had to do with a labor issue, as you mentioned, essentially how many votes employees need to unionize. Under this legislation, employees would need more signatures than they did in the past. I just talked to somebody who opposes this bill, Candace Johnson. She's with the Communications Workers of America.
This reauthorization bill has made that incredibly difficult, much harder than it has to be, and all because of ideology, not because there should have been anything in the bill that dealt with this issue at all.
David, organized labor said that above all else, this piece of legislation just wasn't the right place to deal with issues like this one.
Tell you what also caught my eye, drones. The measure says that a few years from now, there might be pilotless robot planes circling around.
That's right. And there's a lot of interest in this, as you might imagine. Scientists want to use drones for research. Police departments, they want to get their hands on some of the surveillance technology that the military has been using. This legislation says that a plan has to be in place within these next few years that would allow more drones in U.S. airspace. And now, of course, the government's got a lot to sort out. There are concerns about privacy, David, but also about safety.
Sure. What's the worst that could happen? Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Senate is working on some legislation this week aimed at boosting the nation's defenses against cybercrime. But as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, utility companies oppose new regulation because they say it allows too much government intrusion into their business.
Most of America's critical infrastructure is owned and operated by private companies. Increasingly, they use network software, making them vulnerable to hackers. Jacob Olcott is a cybersecurity expert at Good Harbor Consulting. He says given the potential catastrophic consequences of an attack,
many people are coalescing around the idea that the government does play a role, some role, in protecting those systems and assets.
But companies are warning Congress not to add to their regulatory burden. Liesl France, for example, with Tech America, says new government requirements could make it tougher to react.
Probably a most salient example is the time it takes to devise and promulgate and enforce a regulatory framework vis-a-vis the time that it takes for a cyber attack to occur.
France says instead of imposing new regulations, government should make it easier for industries that are under threat to quickly share information. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Today, the mining company Xstrata agreed to get together with the commodities trading firm Glencore in a $90 billion merger. I don't blame you if you've never heard of these companies, but just for some context, $90 billion is about what analysts say Facebook is going to be worth when it goes public.
Which, David, either says something about the overvaluing of Facebook or the undervaluing of these mining companies, or maybe it's just apples and oranges. I'm not sure. Joining us to demystify this merger is John Meyer. He's a mining analyst with Fairfax Investment Bank, and he's with us from Cape Town, South Africa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell me, first of all, why this deal matters within the mining industry.
This deal is a landmark for the industry. It ties up one of the world's largest miners, which is particularly important in copper and coal, with the world's largest and arguably most successful trading company, which is critical in the supply of raw materials into manufacturing companies around the world.
So you've got a company that can then both mine the material and then sell it.
Yes. In many cases, a miner will go through a trading company which has better connections with the manufacturers and the end users, particularly good connections into China, the Eastern Bloc, really tentacles all over the planet, and it's critical to global trade.
Why does it matter to ordinary Americans? How do we interact with these companies, even if it's far down the chain?
It's really important from a safety perspective that the companies that produce these products, these specialty steels or consumer electronics products, where we depend on the structural integrity of that steel so that our railways are safe, so that our cars hold together in the right way, so that our houses are structurally sound.
John Meyer is a mining analyst at Fairfax Investment Bank. John, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Western Union is a 19th century brand that's still kicking. Telegrams are no longer big business, of course, but sending money back to foreign relatives is. Marketplace's Scott Tong has more on the day that Western Union will reveal its latest profits.
The world economy is limping, but remittances from migrant workers to their families back home are charging ahead. They grew 8% last year to $351 billion, according to the World Bank. That's an all-time high, following a soft patch in 2009. To put it all in context, remittances tripled the amount sent from governments to other governments via foreign aid. Why the resilience? The World Bank's Dilip Rathi says when times get tough, migrants find a way to suck it up.
They consume a bit less, or they share accommodation with others, and then they send the saving back home, because every dollar that you send from here can mean so much more in a place like Bangladesh or in Mexico.
Another reason? The dollar is still strong in places like Mexico and India. And if a dollar goes a long way, migrants here send lots of them home. The U.S. is the world's largest source of remittances. Outflows from the United States last year grew by 8%. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now to a special kind of lottery in New Haven, Connecticut. The prize isn't cash, but it's something awfully valuable, a place to live. Winners will get to move into a brand new public housing community. Craig LaMolt was there as people lined up to apply.
Richard Estrada says winning this lottery would mean a lot to him.
A great deal, because I got two little boys. One is autistic, so I need a larger space for him.
Estrada's not the stereotypical public housing tenant. He's got a good job running maintenance for the city's police stations. but it's still tough to make ends meet.
Everything is counted for, you know, on my part. So, you know, hopefully it goes well.
If it does go well, he'll get to live in a brand new public housing community, not a project.
We've given up that word.
That's Karen DuBois-Walton, the Housing Authority's director. The change is more than just semantics. These are individual homes with front and backyards. This lottery is for the city's working poor. The idea is to get people with different incomes living together.
It stabilizes communities. It is helpful for communities to see and benefit from people getting up and going to work every day.
The federal government funds hundreds of mixed-income communities like this around the country. New Haven is using some money for this development that would have otherwise supported housing vouchers. People can use vouchers to help pay rent at apartments around the city. Bob Ellickson, who teaches property law at Yale, says these mixed-income communities are way better than the old model of clustering the poorest people in massive projects.
But I think inferior to portable housing vouchers, which are much more flexible and which provide aid to twice more families than these projects do, and also can be targeted to the families that are the most in need.
Federal housing officials say rent vouchers can only do so much. This project is a brand new development with built-in social services like job training. Add in the lottery to mix things up economically, and they say you may have created a community that can make some progress against poverty. In Connecticut, I'm Craig LaMolt for Marketplace.
So, is this what the doctor had in mind when she prescribed an apple a day? The mega brewing company Miller Coors has just bought an outfit called Crispin Cider Company of Minnesota. This is hard cider. Crispin's sales doubled last year. Plus, Anheuser-Busch, another brewery without micro in the title, is coming out with something called Michelob Ultralight Cider. Advertising age sees a trend here. At the moment, Woodchuck is the brand to beat. It has nearly half the hard cider market in America, and it's produced by a privately held company in Vermont. Call it reverse distillation. Ohio is about to turn liquor into jobs. From now on, profit from selling liquor will convert into lots of operating revenue for something called Jobs Ohio. It's a privately run job creation agency. Alcohol sales have risen even as the state's economy has slumped, and it's not just about imported spirits. Ohio has a homegrown alcohol industry, as Brian Bull from WCPN in Cleveland reports.
Last year was one of the rainiest ever in Northeast Ohio. Not the best weather if you raise grapes. But Nick Ferrante of Ferrante Winery in Geneva, Ohio, is toasting 2011 anyway because of strong sales.
We just loaded like 15 cases of wine into a gentleman's car. So I think we're going to finish strong, maybe 5 or 6%.
Over last year?
Yes, I think so.
The Ohio Department of Commerce says there are now 164 licensed winemakers, about a third more than there was 5 years ago. The number of licensed beer makers has nearly doubled from 2007. Commerce head David Goodman says alcohol sales in Ohio are at record highs.
So far this year, we're at approximately $770 million in revenue, which is historic.
That growth jibes with national alcohol sales. Craft breweries in particular have seen beer sales improve over the last 2 years. Good news for companies like the Great Lakes Brewing Company based in Cleveland. Its kegging line rolls barrel after barrel almost nonstop. Co-owner Patrick Conway says Great Lakes saw record sales last year, up 30% over 2010. And he added 20 new positions.
And we are penciling in another healthy double-digit growth for next year, I think around 20-25%.
Seems like most alcohol makers share these high hopes, including entrepreneurs like Tom Licks, who'll introduce his Cleveland whiskey brand next summer. While many startups are dealing with post-recession jitters, Licks is confident.
5 years from now, we'll be a $50 million company, employ up 35 or 40 people, and I think that'll be a great success for us.
In an economy where it seems every major industry has dried up, alcohol flows on. In Cleveland, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
Puerto Rico has a problem with iguanas. The U.S. territory has some 4 million of them, and wait till you hear what the government wants to do about it. Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
They want to slaughter the iguanas, then sell them overseas to butchers and restaurant owners. There aren't many natural predators in Puerto Rico.
I know if I was able to bring it into the UK, I know I would be able to sell it.
That's Paul Cook. He owns Osgrow. It's a distributor based in the UK, specializing in things like ostrich meat, snails, locusts.
We're not selling iguana in the UK, only in pet shops as pets.
Cook says there's a growing market for what are called exotic meats. Puerto Rico wants to capitalize on that. Immigrants want to cook what they ate back home. World travelers want to recreate meals they had on vacations. Cook runs a side business, a gastropub that caters to the curious.
And you tend to sort of eat your way through the menu with the number of visits.
It looks unlikely Cook will get his hands on Puerto Rican iguana anytime soon. The plan is for the meat to be distributed in the U.S. first. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
And finally, the ratings are in, and the Super Bowl was the most watched TV program in U.S. history. 111.3 million people tuned in. But, David, get this. The halftime performance by Madonna, the one we were talking about yesterday, drew even more viewers, 114 million of
them. So Madonna did better than the game.
That's right. Wild. People tuned in for Madonna, not the game, or at least a few million more people did. The halftime performance by Madonna was also a hit on Twitter with 10,245 tweets per second. And I'm sure all of them were just riveting, interesting, and informative tweets.
Did you see she tripped? Did you see she tripped? Over and over.
Retweet, retweet, retweet. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.